I lived in a mobile home growing up, and the tornadoes were our worst nightmare. You know, tornadoes can take out a much sturdier home than a mobile home, so mobile homes don't have a chance. So our real strategy was when there was a tornado warning in the area, we just were hoping we weren't at home. We were hoping we were somewhere else, or that we could get to this store there around the corner from us that was under a building and in the side of a hill. That's where we hoped we could get to. So when I was growing up, we didn't have weather alerts on our cell phones because we didn't have cell phones. So you didn't have the opportunity that could warn you about what was coming. And there are certain conditions where a tornado happened, tornadoes happen. But those conditions kind of pop up out of nowhere sometimes. So there isn't a lot of warning with a tornado. Hurricanes, though, it's a little different story. We grew up where we lived in Florida for 8 years, and there were a couple occasions where it looked like a tornado was coming right for us. But with the hurricane, you have a lot more warning. You start watching TV, a week in advance. You get to watch where all the spaghetti lines of the models are telling you where they think is going to hit you. And you can take your time to make sure that you're ready to board up your house and to make sure and go and visit somebody who's not in Florida at the time. But you can prepare for both situations. The preparation for hurricanes involves making sure you have the things that you need to put up. They're the right size to put up to cover your windows. But the preparation for a tornado is much different than that. You're preparing for right then, when it happens. If you're outside, you're trying to get to the lowest place possible. If you're inside, you're trying to find either the basement or the innermost room that's away from all the windows. But and actually in schools, that you have a similar kind of situation where you have tornado drills. And in those drills, your kids are getting up and going to the right location, and they're getting in the right position. They have hurricane drills, which consist of random warnings that 36 hours from now there's a hurricane and you need to make sure and take precautions. So hurricanes, they cancel school. You don't need that right at the last minute kind of drill. Well, in our passage this morning, Jesus is preparing his disciples for his coming. And the way he describes his coming, it's sudden, like a tornado. But the preparation is not like that. The preparation is more like how you might prepare for a hurricane. It's constant, consistent action in preparation for his coming. So that's how you can be ready for this unexpected coming. So we're not going to have a second coming drill this morning. But if you were going to have something like that, a second coming drill, it would involve the entirety of your life. Or when Christ comes back, whichever were to come first. So this morning, we're going to be in Matthew 24. You can turn there. Matthew 24, we're going to be looking at, again, verses 36 to the end of the chapter. And I can summarize this section in one sentence. In these 16 verses, Jesus is saying, you cannot know when he's coming, so be ready by doing what he's told you to do. So you cannot know when Jesus is coming, so be ready by doing what he told you to do. And from that summary, I think you could see three ways to prepare for Jesus' return. So in light of what he says here, you need to expect the unexpected, be ready, and do your job. So let's look at the first way to prepare for Christ's return, and that's to expect the unexpected. Expect the unexpected. That is something that Christians throughout history have really needed to learn. In his commentary on Matthew, Douglas O'Donnell lists out a number of professing Christians who made predictions throughout the centuries on when Christ would return. He began with predictions from the second and third centuries, where people predicted that Jesus was going to come back in AD 500. He did not. And then many predicted that Christ would return on January 1st in the year 1000. And despite errors in the dating of Christ's birth or in the odd assumption that Jesus is going to follow the Julian calendar, none of that mattered. Jesus came nowhere close to the year 1000. And then in the Middle Ages, Pope Innocent took the year that the religion of Islam started, that was AD 618. He added the number for the beast, 666, and he came up with this prediction of Christ coming back in the year 1284. He did not. Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormon religion, he said that Christ is going to come back around the year 1890. He did not. Charles Taze Russell, who led this movement that resulted in Jehovah's Witnesses, predicted, as I mentioned last week, that Christ would return in 1914. And even though some of his followers say he did come back, it was just secret. Truth is, he did not come back in 1914. In 1986, a group of people called the Children of God predicted that Christ would return in 1993. He did not. In 1988, there were multiple predictions that Christ would return that year. He did not. In 1998, both a Taiwanese cult in Texas, don't know how they got there, but that cult, along with so-called psychic Edgar Cayce, claimed that Christ was going to come back that year. Just so happens that year is 666 times 3. Maybe that was significant for some reason. But he did not come back in 1998. Harold Camping, who I became familiar with when I was up in the Chicago area, he predicted in 1994 that Christ would return on May 21st, 2011. When that prediction failed, he adjusted it to October 21st, 2011. But again, Christ did not return. Now, Camping had the audacity to predict the actual day, which in view of our passage this morning seems like the dumbest thing you could possibly do. In, at least in the other cases, you know, they're just predicting a year. And so they could have argued, well, Jesus said the day or the hour. You know, maybe you can predict the year. But that actually goes against what Jesus is teaching here. It's entirely against what Jesus is teaching. The point of Jesus' teaching here in chapter 24 is that you should expect the unexpected. And that excludes predicting any timing. Whether that's an hour, day, week, month, year, decade, on and on. The point is, date setting is not how disciples prepare for Christ's return. Because the return, Jesus says here, is unexpected. So he starts by emphatically saying that the only one who knows when the Son will come is the Father. And I say he says this emphatically because of how he says it. He starts in verse 36 by saying, but concerning that day and hour, no one knows. And then he says, not even the angels of heaven. And then he adds, nor the Son. And then he finally concludes, but the Father only. Now, the simplest way to say that is, only the Father knows the day and an hour. But he says it emphatically here. So the angels, they'd obviously be good candidates to know when this is happening because they're in heaven. They're likely to have overheard something. God's going to say something. But they don't know. And of course, you'd expect the Son to know when he's coming back. But not even the Son himself knows when that will be. Now, that prompts the question, does the Son still not know? And after studying this passage and thinking about it, here's my answer. I don't know. I have no idea. I think the idea is helpful to hear that Jesus says he doesn't know. That's really important for us to hear because it fits with other things that we know about Jesus when he was here. So there's one characteristic of deity we know well, omnipresence, being everywhere. Jesus in his humanity was not everywhere. He was in one locality. And even his mighty works were not expressions of Jesus' own almighty, omnipotent power. Because Jesus says that they were works of the Holy Spirit that had come upon him at his baptism. So even those things were not examples of his omnipotence. So when we hear about Jesus having this lack of omniscience in his humanity, we're not surprised. That's just one other expression of his very real experience of humanity. So in Hebrews 2:17, the author explains Jesus was made human like us in every respect. So he had a completely human experience, even though he didn't sin. So the ignorance of the time that he expresses here, that's just part of his truly human experience. Now, how his glorified human state interacts with his divinity now, I haven't the slightest. So I have no idea whether the Son, in his glorified humanity, still does not know the hour of the day, being God and man. the point here that Jesus is saying is that only the Father knows when the Son will come. And he isn't telling anybody. He hasn't shared it. Not even with the angels. Not even with the Son. And some people might think about that and think, well, God's not sharing his timing because he doesn't want somebody to cheat the system. He doesn't want somebody to somehow sneak in at the end. That's just silly talk. Think about that. If you're hard-hearted enough to think that you're going to just live your life now for yourself and wait to the last minute to genuinely turn from your sin to follow, you're just kidding yourself. Your hard heart isn't going to change at the last minute. So God's not worried about that. He's not holding back this information because he's afraid that someone's going to respond that way, just waiting to the last minute and then scooting in so that they get the best of this world and the next. That is not what God's concerned about. In fact, God has rescued many brands from the fires of hell right at the last moment. God has done that. So that's not his concern. God is a gracious and merciful God. He is free to save some at the first hour as well as the 11th. God isn't sharing this information because of the preparation that we need to have, because of the focus we need to have. It's not on the timing. So as we listen to what Jesus says here, we'll better understand why God's doing it this way. Jesus goes on to explain more fully what he's saying in verse 37. And he starts with this comparison. And as with other comparisons, like in parables, we have to be careful about what is Jesus comparing here. He states the comparison in verse, as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. What does that mean? Well, in verse 38, he starts to explain. In the days before the flood, people were continuing to do ordinary things. They were chewing their food, swallowing their beverages. That's kind of the way that he says this. They were even marrying. There were weddings right up to the day when Noah entered the ark. And then verse 39 gives the major point for mentioning these continued regular events of life. He says they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away. In other words, their activity demonstrated that they had no idea that the flood was coming when it came. That's the way the coming of the Son of Man will be. No one will know exactly when it's happening before it happens. So the question we need to answer is, how does this, what Jesus says here, fit with what he already said about his coming in this chapter, in verse 39 or 29. It's just a little bit before this. So Jesus hasn't suddenly said, I'm talking about this coming. Oh, nope, now I'm talking about this one. This is the same coming as in verse 29, where he says that the Son of Man is coming immediately after the tribulation of those days, after the sun being darkened, the moon not giving its light, the stars falling from heaven, and the powers of the heavens being shaken. Verse 30 describes the tribes of the earth, all of them, seeing this and mourning. So this is not a secret return where only Jesus' followers see him. This is public. Everyone sees this, and they're mourning because he comes with great power and glory. And they know what's going to happen to them because of that. So that's the coming of the Son of Man. And that's what he's describing here. Even before those events, though, so he's listing out some things that do happen before his coming in verse 29. But even before that, in verse 14, he says the gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations before the end will come. So Jesus does not appear to be saying that there is nothing that can precede his coming. This is not identical to him saying he can come at any moment. You might be able to find that somewhere else. But here he's simply saying this is unexpected. When he comes is going to be unexpected. Something still could be expected before that. And that's not the only place where Jesus told his followers that something was going to happen before his return. He told Peter that he was going to have a martyr's death at an old age. So anybody listening to that, they would know Jesus isn't coming back before Peter dies as an old man in a martyr's death. So the stress of this passage is not on this idea of Christ returning at any moment. That's not the case. What's the point? Why should we expect the unexpected? Because it negates the tendency that the disciples illustrated at the very beginning of this. What did the disciples want to know? What started this whole conversation? They wanted to know, when are you coming back, Jesus? And what are going to be the signs that tip us off that it's happening? And Jesus is saying, that's not the right attitude. That's not what you're supposed to be doing. That's not what your focus is supposed to be. The exact timing is not what you should be focused on. You need to expect that this is going to be unexpected. Plan on not knowing when Christ is returning. No Christian should attempt to figure out when Jesus is coming back. That's what Jesus is telling us right here. Don't do that. That's not how you prepare. We prepare by expecting the unexpected, but then second, the second way we prepare for Christ's return is to be ready. Don't set dates. Be ready. Be in a state of readiness. Like when a woman is pregnant. There's a state of readiness that should be the case. Now, there's lots of things you have to get ready for when a woman is pregnant. You know, the wife and the husband, they need to get ready for the baby in lots of different ways. You know, get clothes, get the baby's room ready, get diapers, get bath supplies, all kinds of things. That's getting ready. That's not being ready. One of the greatest comedic tropes when it comes to pregnancies is the scene where the baby's coming and nobody's ready. And where, whether it's I Love Lucy, Bill Cosby, Friends, or any movies you might have seen where this is happening. There's always this scene where it doesn't matter if they've prepared for this child and everything is ready in that sense. When it's time for them to go to the hospital, there's just panic. Everybody's panicked. They don't know what to do. They're all running around. Now, there's another version of this where one person's ready and the other isn't. And you can guess who the person almost always is who's ready and who's not ready. The husband is not ready. You know, so whether they're running in and they've left their wife in the car, or they can't fill out any of the paperwork, or they're hyperventilating, and now the medical staff's all focused on them instead of why they came in the first place. But then you have the wife there, and she's all calm. She's in pain, but she's not panicked. So regardless of whether that's a fair stereotype or not, what Jesus is getting at is that kind of readiness that impacts your behavior. The state, this mindset of being ready. That's what he's talking about in verses 40 to 44. So he goes on to describe what's going to happen when he returns in glory. He says, at that time, two men will be in the field. One will be taken and one left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and one left. So you have men and women doing the daily kinds of chores and things that they were doing in their day. Men are in the field farming. Women are grinding the grain into flour in the mill. So one has one experience, and the other has another experience. So what's happening? What's happening to the one taken and the one left? What seems to me as I read these different commentaries and listen to different preachers on this, it seems to be very clear when you're reading this that it perfectly fits your perspective on the timing of Christ's return. So if you believe in a pre-tribulational rapture, where Christ takes the church before the tribulation, it is very clear to you that taken means taken to be with Christ, and left behind is what happens to those who experience the tribulation. That's just obvious, right? But if you believe in a post-tribulational rapture, where Christ comes back for his people after the tribulation, then you think it's quite obvious that taken means taken in judgment, and left behind means left to experience the kingdom. Wouldn't it be nice if it were obvious which one is right? Because in the context, you can see both ideas. In verse 31, Jesus describes himself gathering his elect, taking them to be with him. And even though the language is not identical, the verb used there isn't the same one as here, it could be the same idea. But then in our own passage, in verse 29, you have Jesus describing the flood generation being taken away in judgment. And even though the NASB and the NIV are slightly more accurate in translating that took them away, it's not the same Greek word used here for taken. So it could be either. What you can clearly see is that there is a drastically different experience for these two people, these two individuals, when Christ comes in glory. So Jesus is going to explain this in greater detail in chapter 25. But what he seems to be describing here is the experience of either reward or punishment when he returns. That's what awaits everyone. Either reward or punishment. And so that extreme difference is what calls for this readiness. Jesus puts it this way in verse 42. He says, "Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming." Staying awake, it's that mindset of readiness. It's that vigilance of being aware. And Jesus is going to explain that in his second example. His second example is in verse 43. He expands on this idea of staying awake. He describes a scenario where a thief comes at night to dig either through the mud brick home or through the roof or dig under the dirt floor and steal something. And so Jesus says, if the master of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have left his house to be broken into. I think Leon Morris explains what Jesus meant here well. He says, as he puts it, Jesus is saying that if the man knew approximately when the burglar would come, he would keep watch and protect his goods. He could safely neglect watching at all other times. Since he does not, he must take responsible precautions at all times or run the risk of losing his valuable goods. Constant readiness is the only safeguard. So Jesus gives his conclusion in verse 44. He says, "Therefore you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect." Jesus isn't saying you have to stay up all night, all the time. He's not even telling you what readiness looks like yet. He's just saying that this is why readiness is not a only now and then kind of readiness. You can't figure out when Christ is going to return. So you can't pinpoint when you need to be ready, which means you need to always be ready. You need to be always in this state of readiness. So how do we avoid being the panicked husband? You know, how do we avoid being caught off guard? How do we avoid that? How do we make sure that we're in this state of readiness? What does it look like? Jesus goes on to explain that. And remember how I summarized the passage. You cannot know when Jesus is coming, so be ready by doing what he told you to do. We could say it this way. Do your job. That's the third way to prepare for Christ's return. Do your job. Now, as many of you may know, I am no fan of Bill Belichick. Not even in the slightest. But he does have this well-known mantra, and I think there's some redeemability to it. Do your job. What it means for him has to do with kind of how he views his players, frankly. So one sports writer put it this way. He said, Belichick views players as commodities, moving parts in a system. And what that basically means is every individual player just needs to do his job. And if he doesn't do his job, he's going to get benched or traded. Even the good players. Now, I do think maybe Tom Brady is a slight exception, but typically Tom did his job when he was there. So I don't want us to take away from that Bill's attitude towards people, because that fact is why people who played with him for years and years don't like him at all. But in the realm of football, this idea of football players having this singular focus on doing their job, that is redeemable. Football player gets paid to do a particular job, and they should focus on that job. They shouldn't be caught up with all their, you know, endorsements and non-essential aspects of celebrity life. Now, they should be at the birth of their child or other important events. I'm going to just say that. But there are numerous peripheral benefits to being a football player that shouldn't distract them from doing their job. And that's what I think is admirable about this mantra. Football players should do their job. They should be focused on that. And believers should too. That's what it means to be ready. You're in a state of readiness. You're in that state of readiness when you're faithfully doing what your master has told you to do. Jesus begins in section verses 45 through 51 with the word then. And that word shows us that this is the conclusion to his thought here. This is where everything in this section has been heading. This is why we need to expect the unexpected and be ready. And he makes, again, a comparison between his followers and slaves who belong to a master. Now, for us, that imagery, it's difficult to swallow because we know humans are not supposed to own other humans. We know that. But this comes from their context. And when we think about our relationship to the one who made us, and not only made us, but sustains us at every millisecond. And when we add to that the fact that this is a loving master who not only did he make us, but rescues us from our sin and promises this amazing future for us to enjoy. When we put it in that kind of a picture, it's not the kind of way that we first think when we hear about slavery. So Jesus, once again, he points out this very different experience that his followers can have. And he starts with the positive experience. Those who are faithful and wise, those who are trustworthy, you can count on them. Those who are wise, they hear his instructions and they do them, just like he described the person in Matthew 7:24. Built their house on the rock, not the sand. So here he describes the faithful and wise follower like this. He's like a slave whom his master has set over his household. His master put him in charge of all the other slaves to take care of them, to make sure to give them their food at the proper time. He says in verse 46, blessed is the servant, that servant, whom his master will find so doing when he comes. The slave who's found faithfully doing what his master told him to do when his master comes is the slave you want to be. That's the idea of blessed. That's what it basically means. The person who's blessed has the experience that everyone should desire. And then Jesus explains what that desirable experience is in verse 47. Truly I say to you, he will set him over all his possessions. So this faithful and wise slave is going to be rewarded with even greater responsibility. He's enjoying, or he will get to enjoy, all of his master's possessions. He's given at first this responsibility to oversee these other slaves, and his reward is that he gets to manage his master's possessions. Now, obviously, he's not supposed to mismanage them, but understand what that would mean for a slave, to be in charge of all your master's possessions. You would be in your master's shoes. You would get to enjoy their wealth. You're the one managing it. That's what he's describing here. For us in our kingdom context that Jesus is describing, it means that the faithful and wise disciple gets to enjoy his master's kingdom. What about the disciple who doesn't do this? Jesus turns to explain in verse 48 what that will be like. And Douglas O'Donnell, I thought, was very helpful in pointing out that the slave who is not faithful and wise, he's not described as foolish. He's called wicked. This wicked slave, he says to himself in verse 48, my master is delayed. He's not coming back immediately. So you can already see he kind of has an idea. He thinks he knows when his master's going to come back, and it's not yet. And instead of focusing on his job, which is managing these other slaves, providing for them, thinking of them, he beats his fellow slaves. Instead of providing food for them, he eats and drinks with drunkards. So he's turning away from doing his job that's actually focused on the good of his fellow slaves to take these gifts that his master's given and use them for his own benefit. And really his own benefit alone. So what's going to happen to that wicked slave? Jesus tells us in verses 50 and 51. And in verse 50, he repeats the premise, the basic premise of this whole section. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he does not know. And what's going to happen when he arrives? Well, verse 51 says he will cut him in pieces and put him with the hypocrites in that place where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, in reading that, it does seem odd to me that he's going to be cut in pieces and then put in a place of weeping and gnashing of teeth. So there was a commentator who suggested that this verb, cut in pieces, should be translated more cut off. That Old Testament idea of people being cut off from God's people, which fits here. They're being cut off from the kingdom. They're not getting to enjoy that place. Instead, they're going to be in this other place. They're going to join the rest of the hypocrites, where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. I say rest of the hypocrites because that's what Jesus is describing here. Understand, both of these slaves are supposed to be his followers. That's the image. They're both professing followers of Jesus. But that's not what's really happening. It's what they present as happening, but it's not really happening. Just like with the Pharisees who would say, oh, no, we're following God. We're doing what he says. And we're doing these outward forms of righteousness, but really they weren't. It wasn't true righteousness. It wasn't what they were supposed to be doing. So here this person is saying they're repenting of their sin. They believe Jesus is their Lord and they're following it, but they're not following him. Their life isn't about doing what's best for others. It's about doing what's best for them. It's not self-sacrificing, it's self-centered. And what Jesus means is that it does not matter how joyfully you first turn from your sins to follow him. If there's no perseverance in following him, you will end up in that place where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. That place of regretful, bitter weeping and agonizing gnashing of teeth. Your conversion experience, how you experienced conversion, does not ensure that you escape hell. Does that mean you can lose your salvation? No. It means that even if you really did believe that you were turning from your sin and trusting in Jesus, that gospel seed may not have really settled in good soil. Means that whatever joy you truly felt, it was a joy, you felt it. It did not flow out of a saving work of the Holy Spirit. Those who are saved in the end are those who persevere, not just those who got off to a good start. Both of these slaves represent people who turn to follow Jesus. One is found doing the job Christ gave them to do. They're found doing that when he returns. One is doing what they want instead of what their master wants. So our response to this is simple. Do your job. Jesus called you to follow him. That's your job. That's the task. Now that you've heard this good news, that Jesus is the King who came and died. He came and rose again to rescue you from your sin. Now that you've believed that he's your King and your Savior. Now that you've turned from your sin to follow him, do that. Follow him. Do your job. That's the only way to be ready for his return. You don't need to know when he's coming back. You can't know that. And you don't need to know it. You simply need to be ready by continuing to do what he's told you to do. So how do you do that? That's what we focus on every week here, doing that. Church has been called to take those who trust in Jesus, to baptize them into our group, and then to teach them every week what it means to follow Jesus. So, we, from every part of Scripture, are learning what Christ commands his followers. So I'd say one application of what Jesus tells us to do here is to join us as we do that. To join us consistently as we do that. That's how we persevere. We do it together. Keeping each other accountable. There are so many professing Christians who think that they can do what Jesus says on their own. Understand, much of what Jesus instructed his followers through his apostles and prophets to do has to do with treating how we treat each other, fellow disciples. What was that slave's responsibility? It had to do with his fellow slaves. They all had the same master. The focus was not actually on outsiders in this text. What the master had given them to do related to the people that were also his, belonged to him. Much of what Jesus has to say about preparing for him and for this kingdom that we're going to be a part of has to do with being a part of a community of believers. Doing these one another passages that are not just one another to people that you see on the street, but one another, each other. So if you want to be found faithfully and wisely doing what your master told you to do, you best be a meaningful part of a local church. He's going to reiterate that in chapter 25, that very truth. If you don't want to be a wicked slave who gets cut off from the kingdom and goes to that place of bitter, regretful weeping and agonizing gnashing of teeth, here's how it starts. It starts by turning from focusing on yourself, turning from listening to yourself. You're not your best master. You need a better master. So you need to turn away from your being your own master to Jesus, to believe that he's the king who can save you from yourself, save you from your sin, save you from the punishment Jesus describes here. You need to turn from following what you think and want and listen to him. And then I'd encourage you to be baptized and join us week in and week out as we seek, our desire here is to listen to Jesus. For everyone who would say, I'm doing that, understand what Jesus teaches here. You cannot know when Jesus is coming back. So be ready by doing what he's told you to do. Do your job and be thankful that Jesus is not like Bill Belichick. Because in this passage, he clearly cares about us. He has good things in store for us. Every faithful and wise disciple, he's not just using you for his own success. He wants what's truly best for you. He wants to share his wealth with you. So be prepared to enjoy that by, again, doing what he's called you to do right now. You know, the title of my message, my sermon was Prepping for Christ's Return. My wife had a different message. It's probably a better, or a different title. It's probably a better title. She suggested Prepper's Gonna Prep. We are preppers in a way. You know, end of the world preppers. But we prepare for the end of the world differently than your typical doomsday prepper, right? They're self-centered in their prep. It's all about their own personal survival, you know, stockpiling, having the things that you need to survive. For Jesus, it's the exact opposite. We prepare for the end, not by trying to preserve our own lives. That person doesn't make it in the end, according to Jesus. If you do that, if you just try to preserve your life, you don't get to save your life. Instead, it's the person who follows the one who gave up his life for others. That's how you make it in the end, by following his example. So when we think about the end, just to understand, no matter what your view is of the end times, no matter how you've put together the rapture and the tribulation, just understand this. Do not be focused on this worry about what happens to you. That is the exact opposite of what Jesus teaches here. That does not encourage constant faithfulness and wisdom no matter what happens. Concern for making sure that you have the you have a life that has the least amount of difficulties. That is the most non-response, that is the most opposite response to this text you could possibly have. That's not the way of the cross. That's our calling. To pick up our cross, our implement of execution. That's what Jesus called every single one of us to follow our master. Blessed is the one found doing that when he returns. That's the prepper who makes it. Not the one focused on preserving their life. Not the one focused on having their best life. The one who's giving up their life for the sake of others. Just like their master did for them. Join me in prayer. Father, we are so prone to seek our own self-preservation. That's our knee-jerk response to life. It's a way in which you've built us to not touch a hot stove if it's hot. We recognize that. There's just natural tendency in us to not harm ourselves. That has a good side to it. We shouldn't try to harm ourselves. But apart from your grace, that's really what our lives are all about. Protecting ourselves, insulating ourselves from any types of trouble or difficulty or things that inconvenience us even. That's what you've rescued us from. In this world full of people doing that, full of people who don't know what other people have been through and are going through and don't care to think about it. Just think about what's happening to them right in that moment. And if anybody does anything that doesn't fit with that, they're going to respond poorly. That's what our world is full of. That's what you've rescued us from through your Son, so that we can be like you. So we can be like your Son who gave up what was beneficial to himself, sacrificed his own life for people who didn't even care about him. You made us to be like that and to one day fill this world with people whose focus is on caring for others. So help us even now, by your Spirit and by your Word, to recognize just how vital it is that we already start to put that in practice. Help us to put it into practice here in our church. That we'd be thoughtful, thinking about the needs of the people around us, not thinking about how someone slighted us, didn't focus on us, didn't do something for us. That you would work in our hearts this desire to be like Jesus. That would be what reflects our congregation. And that it would overflow beyond this congregation to the people around us. They would see these good works that are the product of your Spirit at work in us. And they would glorify you. They would turn to Christ and glorify you. Help us to be doing what we should be doing. In our own strength, we cannot do this. We cannot be consistent. We cannot continue. So by your Spirit, grant us strength. And by this community of faith, grant us this endurance. Father, anyone who is here does not or is not really following you, following your Son, that they would recognize it. They'd be responsive to this good news in a way that reflects good soil, in a way that reflects a changed heart, a heart that is now concerned chiefly with you and your glory, and then reflecting that concern with our following your example and your love for everyone. I ask for your grace and mercy for them and for us, for all of us, in this way. Amen.